Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, saluting Earth Day on April 22nd with an ongoing commitment to help offset carbon emissions with sustainable harvesting of Missouri forests. Details at choosewood.com.
Welcome to a special edition of St. Louis on the Air. I'm Sarah Fenske. Arthi Shahani was born in Morocco but grew up in Queens. Her parents were undocumented, and the five members of the Shahani family shared a one-bedroom apartment, a roach den, she writes. But then their hard work started to pay off. The family bought a four-bedroom colonial in New Jersey. They even got a dog. It would have been the American dream, only instead it quickly became a nightmare. Arthi Shahani's new memoir about her journey and her family's is called Here We Are. It came out on October 1st, and it's a wonderful read. A quick note that the audio we're listening to today is a backup recording of a live event we taped last Friday. There was a technical issue with the main recording, and while today's broadcast is not the audio quality that we strive for, we want to make sure to bring you this conversation. So without further ado, let's get to my talk with Arthi, recorded before a live audience. I started by noting that the memoir feels, in many ways, like a tribute to her father, who had a long journey and a difficult path, one that went back to partition. I asked her to give us a crash course in Indo-Pakistani history to explain to us what happened there in 1947.
Sure. The little crash course is, you know, the British had colonized India for more than three centuries, but then they decided they were going to make a very quick exit. And that quick exit involved dividing up the subcontinent into different countries. In broad brushstrokes, one chunk of land for Hindus, another chunk of land for Muslims. It was an effort to appease politicians, so no one was really appeased by it. The man who was drawing the map of the new nation states that would be formed, by the way, was someone who had never set foot on the subcontinent. And it is amazing to me because, you know, there's this notion of objectivity that pops up in newsrooms that I also grapple with a lot. And as I was doing my research for the book, seeing how the same notion influenced the mindsets of colonizers, it just really, I was like, wow, we really as humans timelessly grapple with certain notions. So the land was divided, and I think that for a lot of Americans, what you know about the independence movements in India is the peace movement by Mahatma Gandhi. What you're far less familiar with are the millions of people who were murdered and or uprooted in the process of dividing the land into India and Pakistan. My parents were among those uprooted. To give you a sense of how horrific that violence was, literally, babies were skewered. And I, you know, forgive me for being graphic. People who were riding in trains from one region to another were killed in the cars, and corpses would arrive in the station. This is violence that my mother at that point was an infant. Her memory wasn't forming yet. My father was about six. He remembered, he's now passed. He remembered those things. And what happened to each of them is that because of this reorganization of the world post-colonialism, my parents became effectively stateless. What I think about, you know, my family is part of low-end globalization. Mm-hmm. And some of what I'm recounting in this book, that's actually the majority of migrants. It's not the global elite. It's the global working class that get tossed from place to place and try to find a foothold. And that was who my parents were.
And your father ended up in Casablanca. Oh, what was he doing there?
Yeah, so, you know, my father, he actually started his life as a migrant. I mean, first fleeing from war. And then when he was a teenager, he left the subcontinent altogether to become a migrant worker in Beirut. That was his first stop abroad. He was 19 years old, supporting a family of 13 back home. From Beirut, my father traveled throughout northern Africa. He'd been in Algeria as well. He sort of traveled through countries. And then he landed in Morocco, and he did a combination of work. The sexiest of the work, in my opinion, was he became a film distributor.
And I love that he's not just distributing the movies, he's also censoring them.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you for reading, yes. it's funny because he was distributing Bollywood films. Bollywood is the largest film industry in the world. The B stands for Bombay. And so Dad would take these reels of film to movie theaters throughout the Arab world, but he would have to literally take a scissor and tape and cut out the parts that were too provocative. So like, just to give people an understanding of what that means, like, too provocative did not mean like racy, rated R, like sex scenes. It was like a man and a woman embrace.
Yeah. You know, you couldn't have that in Northern Africa at that time.
No, exactly. And I think that part of what's funny that, you know, as I'm tracing in this book, a journey of a migrant family, a father-daughter story, a young woman coming of age, sort of different layers going on here. What I did realize is, like, I'm really tracing also this radical shifting of, like, sexual and cultural norms, you know, from Dad's age to mine.
Yeah, things changed a whole lot.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I mean, we talk about Tinder now. That's nothing compared to the leaps that happened before.
Yeah. So he and your mom ended up deciding that they were going to move to the U.S., and it was in part, it sounds like, your father's mother was a very difficult person. Your mother decided they needed to get out.
That's right. And, you know, this part of the story, I think, will resonate with a lot of people who know their family's migration story, whether it was your great-grandma coming through Ellis Island or your mom, in my case, coming just in the more recent generation. My mother lived in a joint family. That term means that basically the wife who marries the husband moves in with him and his parents and his brothers. That was the situation they had in Casablanca. Only it was more like my mom and dad secured the place to live, and then my mom made what ultimately was the mistake of inviting her mother-in-law and extended family to come in and move in with them. My paternal grandmother, the word for that is Dadi, I didn't know this before, but my Dadi was quite abusive to my mom. And my mom didn't know the word abuse at the time. It wasn't a word that existed in her vocabulary. It was just tough family life. So my Dadi, for example, would throw food straight at my mom if she didn't like what was on the plate. She required my mom to ask permission to open the refrigerator at times. She required that my mom ask for permission to leave the home. She enforced a really awkward and painful sleeping situation where my Dadi ordered my dad to sleep in the bedroom with her, and my mom had to stay out in the living room on the floor.
You can see how your mom objected to this ultimately.
Yeah, and actually that's not even the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah.
I mean, that's to me the kind of extraordinary thing about it. And I didn't actually know these things until I needed to start making sense of my life through understanding my parents' journey, you know, the continuity from them to me. And yeah, I wasn't aware that my mom was basically living for more than a decade in a highly abusive situation. Also, my mom is the most resilient human being I know. I mean, the most resilient human being I know. So it shocked me to learn that at some point things had gotten so bad she actually tried to take her life.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. But the straw that broke the camel's back was actually, I was born, okay?
And that was not the straw.
No, that's not the straw. Though sometimes, you know, my parents definitely fall again. But I was born, I was an accident, okay?
You were the youngest of three.
The youngest of three, born 14 months after my sister, my big sister. And when my parents brought me home from the hospital to our flat in Casablanca, my grandmother would not allow my mom to enter the home with me because she said, "What have you brought me?" They didn't know the gender that I was. "What have you brought me?" And my mom said, "We have a baby girl." And then my daddy was very upset. "Another girl. What is my son going to do with that?" So she wouldn't let us in the house. So my first night home, so to speak, I kind of never went home. My mom and I went to stay at a friend of my father's. And then my dad agreed to a request my mom had been making, which is like, "Let's take the kids, the three kids, and come to America." And that is not a unique migrant story. It's, I think, a lesser understood one. But coming to this country and leaving a difficult family, crossing the Atlantic or the Pacific, it's much easier in some ways than just moving across the street from that family.
Mm-hmm. You can really get away, put some distance between those bad relationships.
Yeah.
Now, the story of where your parents ended up in Queens, in their original building, in some ways, these were some pretty horrible living conditions. I mean, as you say, roaches were crawling over you as a small child. But in other ways, it was so heartwarming to read about this building. When you look back on that period of your life, what strikes you the most?
You know, and I really appreciate you saying that, because I feel like, yeah, I definitely lived in a roach den, and I really did wake up more than once with a roach crawling on my bare skin. Mm-hmm. Like, that actually happened. The only thing I have a phobia of in life, as far as I know, is roaches. But that said, I mean, my building was awesome otherwise. Like, we were a working class United Nations with a real sense of community. You know, like, a lot of people in this country, we're now beginning to talk about this, deal with isolation and loneliness. I grew up with love, not just for my parents, but the neighbors. I mean, like, I had dozens of aunties and uncles from all walks of life.
And these weren't just other Indian immigrants. These were people from everywhere.
They were from everywhere. You know, like the ones I was closest to, you know, a Jamaican aunt, a Korean aunt, a Chicano godfather of mine from a Christian cult. Like, you know, I just sort of, I had a real, what I mean by the Christian cult, I don't mean to be so shorthand about it, is my mom loved religion. She was basically a god hopper.
That's a great way to describe it.
I mean, that's who mom was. Like, you know, and so Flushing is actually, you could credit it as Flushing, Queens, where I grew up, when I was growing up, was among the most diverse zip codes in the entire country, 11355. Also a birthplace for freedom of religion in the U.S. And so literally, just like every few feet, you could stumble into a different house of worship. So mom would literally take me and my little sister and explore. Like, we went to the Unification Church. If you're not familiar with that, the founder, Sun Myung Moon, who claimed to be a kind of second coming of Christ and performed mass weddings. I'd been to mass weddings as a child with hundreds of people from different countries wedding each other. The Unification Church helped to feed us when we didn't have food. That was a very meaningful form of caretaking. I grew up going to a Korean feminist Zen Buddhist temple. And that kind of exposure, you know, it's kind of funny because President Trump and I, our families both come from Queens. Hmm. And I think that he fundamentally misunderstands the lesson from our hometown. Where I grew up has taught me to be at ease with just about anybody. Like, very little free, like, I can roll with anyone. And that's actually the future. I mean, the march of technology and the migration networks that already exist and how people intermarry and fall in love and how cultures merge, and all of it's pointing to the world is just going to get more and more diverse and integrated. Our hometown, President Trump's in my hometown, is at the forefront of that trend. And when you grow up in that, you actually feel really at ease and prepared for what the world is.
Yeah, that apartment building you grew up in, it was sort of like you were seeing the future of America right there.
Absolutely.
In the early 80s.
You know, nutty things happen too, because, you know, the thing about America, you know, freedom. Did you come here for freedom? For my father, America didn't ever really feel like freedom. It felt like a cold, like physically cold, snow, lonely place where he didn't necessarily feel at ease. For my mom, America was a way to escape, not from communism, from patriarchy. Mm-hmm. She could leave an incredibly controlling, huge family, and she could suddenly matter and have an identity outside of wife and mother.
And she really took to this apartment building.
Oh, she worked it.
Your mom could have been elected president if this apartment building was the one voting.
Yeah, well, she was actually president of the apartment building.
Yeah, so she did, literally. Yeah.
They literally started a tenants association. Once we got our papers, and mom, you know, wasn't afraid to put her name on a sheet of paper. She actually started to organize the neighbors and petition for fixes and things like that. And, like, you know, I remember one time, it was really funny. So mom, who also cooks up a storm, and she speaks six languages. My parents each spoke six languages from their global travels. Mom was particularly then well-positioned to talk to everyone in Spanish, in Hindi, in Urdu, in French, a little bit of Arabic, fluent English. She could talk to everybody. So she started basically having meetings at our home, inviting people over. And one day, Eyewitness News, I believe it was Channel 7, they were doing a national one-hour feature on diversity in America. And they chose to have part of that feature set in my home, in my childhood home.
Literally, in your apartment.
Like, literally, they came into the apartment, and they were basically shooting. The host at the time was Roz Abrams. I vividly remember this. I actually still have the video footage from it. She interviewed me and my mom about the importance of diversity and getting along and talking about our differences. And there were like camera crew, friends piled in the apartment. Now, the only thing is my father had no idea my mother was doing this. And so she just kind of thought, I'll be on national TV and they'll be done with getting all the footage and they'll be out before he comes home from work.
And it didn't quite work out that way.
No, what ended up happening was that they took too long at production cycles that were never what you want them to be.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so dad comes home and like the cameraman scolds him for stepping on a wire and he's like, I'm sorry, I thought this was my home. And it's hilarious. Like literally you can see in what aired on national TV, my parents sitting on the floor together and mom holding dad's hand and she's talking about, yeah, we love our community. And I could just see my father's face fuming, like, what is my wife doing? And she lost her mind.
We're talking to Aarti Shahani about her memoir, Here We Are. We need to take a quick break, but we'll be back shortly to continue this conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, saluting Earth Day on April 22nd with an ongoing commitment to help offset carbon emissions with sustainable harvesting of Missouri forests. Details at choosewood.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to a conversation recorded Friday night. Aarti Shahani was in town to discuss her new book, Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares, which is about her family's immigration story. A quick note that the audio we're listening to today is from a backup recording of last Friday's event. There was a technical issue with the main recording, and it ended up being unusable. While today's broadcast is not the audio quality that we typically strive for, we still wanted to share this conversation. Let's listen back to our talk.
Now, Aarti, you write in one of these passages, you write, to migrate to America, to cross the Pacific or the Atlantic Oceans or the Sonoran Desert is the boldest act of one's life. You do it to be the hero of your own story. Only God must have a sense of humor, because as every undocumented immigrant knows, you can't cross over and stand proud. You have to be invisible. Your parents were undocumented.
Yeah. So was I.
Yes, yeah. And when you were first here. So what ended up changing that for them? They thought it would be Ronald Reagan, but it ended up being a different thing that led to their being able to get on the path to citizenship.
That's right, yeah. And, you know, and I'll answer your question. I do want to say about that, when I was writing Here We Are, it was important to me to tell a family story with real honesty. Come and dissect us as deeply as I have dissected us and decide for yourself what you think about things. I don't really need to push an agenda with anybody. I did, though, need to reflect on a truth that I feel has become really lost. Migrating did not used to be a crime. In much more recent history, migrating got codified into criminal law as a crime, to cross the border, for example. I don't judge people for coming in without papers. I believe many of these people are doing exactly what is best for their families, just like prior generations of Americans have done. And it felt important to me to speak up and not bite my tongue around that. Because I think it's really, I respect those who hold others to the same standards they have met, not to higher standards. And I worry that in our country, we are continuously holding the newcomer to far higher standards than our own families met.
This idea that when my grandparents came here, they learned English, when in many cases, they didn't.
Yeah, exactly. And if you go to Ellis Island, like, you know, this is like an interesting thing to me about it. It's like, I would highly recommend for anyone visiting my hometown, New York City, to visit Ellis Island Museum. It's a wonderful place. You come to learn, like, yeah, so, you know, for example, today they always say, wait online. Why won't they just wait online? Well, frankly, at this point, there's not actually a line to wait on. You'd asked me how my family got our papers. My mom's kid sister, she married an American citizen. They both naturalized citizens. They sponsored us, a sibling petition. That's a process that's now derided as chain migration.
And the president himself has sort of put that in his sights.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, he's talked about it as if it's a bad thing. I actually believe it's the backbone of America. So again, I think that we have a real differing of opinion about what the truth of our identity is. That petition from my auntie took about 4 years to process. Today, that same petition for the very narrow pool of people who are even eligible to apply would be more like 25 years.
Wow.
Now, the Ellis Island immigrants who migrated here, some fleeing persecution or poverty, but plenty of them just adventurous and wanting to check out what this place was about. According to archives of that museum, the average wait time to come and gain entry into this country, 3 to 5 hours on average for the vast majority.
So that's the way some of our grandparents did it.
Exactly. More than a third, or about one third of Americans can trace their roots to Ellis Island. And so I would really encourage, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about my family. I hope what it sparks is more people, and not just first generation immigrants, third, fourth, fifth, looking into their own families.
That actually leads to a great question from Mike in the audience. From Kirkwood. Mike asks, please share your thoughts on the roots of right-wing anti-immigrant populism in the U.S. and Europe, and whether you think this is an aberration or a long-term challenge.
Oh, I think it's a great question. I don't feel that I've read enough, particularly about Europe, to understand the ins and outs and the organized movements that are happening there. What I can say about the U.S. is nativist sentiment flares cyclically. That's not new. It keeps happening. It comes and it goes. What I'm particularly concerned about at the moment is that, President Trump did not start the latest flare-up. What my book does is actually trace back what we're seeing in America today as a legacy of the administration of Bill Clinton in the 1990s. Bill Clinton is actually the person, the president, who'd signed two laws in particular that ushered in a really new legal approach to immigrants and migration, which is an approach that treats us fundamentally as a crime control problem.
Mm-hmm.
President Trump didn't create that. I believe that since Clinton's legacy, we have not had really high political leadership up top stop and question it. I am hopeful that that will change. So what I think needs to happen in the U.S. is we need, for example, now the presidential candidates to understand migration as an inherent good and a constant thing that we want in this country, and to also understand it as an equity issue. Because who are migrants? I mean, they're the working class. That's who they are. That's who we are. And so do you talk about them like they're all suspected criminals and terrorists, or do you actually accept, oh my God, the entire world has been shaken and stirred. Human beings are being forced to move. And this country that was built off of migration will continue to let itself be replenished by it.
We're talking to Aarti Shahani about her book, Here We Are. She's NPR's Silicon Valley correspondent. And you had mentioned this Clinton-era law, mm-hmm. that basically if an immigrant runs into trouble with the law, that they can find themselves, even if they have their papers, they end up getting shown the door. And this ended up becoming a huge issue for your family because of what happened to your dad.
Yeah.
So as you tell in the story, your family's really moving on up.
Oh,
you get
yeah.
a scholarship to this amazing, really expensive prep school.
In today's terms, a Tesla a year.
That is a really expensive prep school.
I didn't pay a penny.
And then everything kind of began to crumble a little bit. So at the time, what did you realize about the legal trouble that your dad was in? I know later you went and did a lot of research, and we'll get to that in a minute.
Sure. So while I was trying to make it in this fancy, hyper-elite world, my father managed to open up a shop, a small electronics store, on the exact same block where he used to shovel snow for $4 and $5 an hour. Okay. He was achieving his dream. He sold Casio watches, Sharp calculators, keyboards. This is before the smartphone era. This is before even before big box retail had really taken off, well before the Amazon era. One day we get a call that Dad and his kid brother, my Uncle Ruffin, have been arrested. And they're at Rikers Island Jail, which is a horrific place in New York City. It is known for example, prisoners being gang raped, people regularly being sliced. It is basically a site of massive human rights atrocities, and people are trying to shut it down now, actually. Dad and my Uncle Ruthven are there. According to New York State, my family has sold watches and calculators to the wrong guys, to members of the Cali drug cartel. So my first reaction when I heard about this, and this is what I really delve into in the book. Before my father was arrested, even when he was doing the thing he was incredibly proud of, running his own business, I was already kind of ashamed of him. I remember in public school, I was so proud when my parents would come for parent-teacher day. Like, oh, they'll just hear how nerdy I am. This is great. At Brearley, I didn't want my parents coming because I just felt like people looked at them like the help. No one invited them to their country house, you know. So I was already grappling with that kind of, you know, a lot of us are ashamed of our parents. We're just not supposed to say it. I said it, okay.
And in high school in particular.
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, in adulthood too. So, I mean, I think it lingers for a lot of people. But when my father was arrested, I felt so betrayed by him. I was like, my life is already hard enough. What the heck did you do, Dad? And I'll add, my professional aspiration ever since I was incredibly little was to be a prosecutor. So
you were on the side of the feds.
I assumed like he did something horribly wrong. And it was a New York State case. It ultimately became the feds in a twist of what happened. But, you know, the one little thing that tempered that reaction, just slightly, just ever so slightly, was the first time I went to Rikers Island to visit my dad. It was a couple days into him being arrested. I went with my brother and my mother. And when we were there in the huge open-air gymnasium, where hundreds of people are waiting to see their loved ones and whatnot, I remember feeling like, what are we doing here? What are we doing here? But then also stopping and looking around and saying, where are all of the white criminals? Does New York City not have any white criminals? This can't be. But according to who's at Rikers, it's only black and brown people who are breaking the law. And that, I didn't know what to make of it yet.
But you felt that.
I did.
Yeah. So you later ended up going back as a journalist and looking at your father's case and reading these court files and even interviewing some of the major players in it.
That's right.
What ended up being your takeaway once you kind of got to the bottom of what happened? Did your dad get railroaded?
You know, it's interesting. One of the people I interviewed while writing this book was the judge who hit the gavel. He and I ended up having a very bizarre kind of reunion of sorts.
And he'd been very fond of you. Is
he was, yeah, no, he really was. Like, you know, we basically got reconnected to each other because once I became like a fancy NPR correspondent, that's how I think about it, it's fancy. Once I became fancy, yeah. I ended up rolling in circles where we had mutual friends. And a mutual acquaintance introduced me to the judge. And that judge, the first time I met him, he remembered my family's case and he'd read up on it and he remembered me very vividly. He's like, young lady, your father and your uncle should never have taken the guilty plea that they did. What a mistake. Now, what I hadn't explained yet to you is that my dad and uncle, when they were up against these charges of money laundering for a drug cartel, the prosecutor talking about our family business, like, you guys are just a front for horrible human beings. They agreed to take 8-month sentences. Now you might wonder, well, if these guys are like big time drug dealers, why would they get 8-month sentences? The prosecutor didn't actually have some huge case, but my family was in a sense one of the few people fried in a botched drug war investigation. The prosecutor wasn't able to get real cartel members.
So you might as well get them.
Well, get who you can because you need to show some numbers. You need to show some convictions. So my father and uncle, they took 8-month sentences. But what ended up happening is because of these laws I just previously mentioned passed under Bill Clinton in the 1990s, the 8-month sentence for each man ended up spiraling into a 14-year legal battle that I ended up fighting until the age of 30, becoming my family's faux defender. The aspiring prosecutor kid becomes a family faux defender. And when I met that judge as an adult, when sort of I thought this chapter of my life had been closed, and he told me, man, that was a bum deal. And then after the judge told me that, at first I actually couldn't really deal with what he was saying. And this is a lesson, by the way, in trauma. You have to be ready for a conversation to actually have it. And if something for you has been horrifically painful and you're afraid of falling back into it, you cannot actually process information about it. So, you know, you'd think as like as someone who appreciates investigative reporting and loves to learn and insatiably curious, one would think, oh, the judge would tell Arthie that. And then she'd be like, tell me more, judge. Let's break out the files. Let's talk about it. No, my reaction was to sit in a sofa, want to die slowly from the inside and run out of his office. And it took me 3 years before I had the wherewithal to call him again. And why did I finally call him again? I mean, in part, when I finally stopped fighting for my family and I left and I sort of made a radical career pivot into NPR journalist from prison activist, which is what I was in my 20s. I was like in my early 30s and I had horrific credit. Like my FICO score was terrifying. And I felt like I could not have anything to do with my family's past until I had a future to look forward to. And so yeah, the time that I called the judge to talk years later about, hey, what you mean, judge? It was around the time that my credit score got really good.
Mm-hmm. That's when you were finally able to grapple with that.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, I thought one of the bitterest ironies in this case, and there were many bitter parts in this, was that here you are, this really enterprising high school student, and because of the connections that you've made at your fancy New York City prep school, that you're working, you're doing everything you can to help your family, and you were able to get a lawyer for your dad. And as I'm reading this book, I'm thinking, oh, of course, you know, she gets this fancy lawyer. Everything's, that's how America works. You get a good lawyer, you're fine. And the great irony here is that this was a lawyer who wasn't really a street fighter, or maybe wasn't used to going to court, or maybe didn't care.
Yeah, I think it's more kind of like we were punching above our weight. Yeah. So what happens when you're a working class person who got a fancy lawyer through some random connection, but we weren't important enough to matter to him. And he wasn't fighting for us. You know, when I look back at it in retrospect, and the judge told me this, he's like, you made a big mistake hiring that guy. He didn't do anything for you. The most basic things, you know, in addition to talking to the judge, I actually went back while writing this book and I looked at the indictment against my family. And for the first time as an adult, I noticed that there were several people named on that indictment, not just my family members in our store. So there were the Shahanis in our store. And then there were a bunch of Latino names. So I called up, I tried to reach everybody I could, and I managed to get the guy who on the indictment was called El Burro, the donkey. El Burro, I got his number because I went to the Queens courthouse, I pulled up everyone's file, and he had been filing appeals because he was 7 years into a prison sentence. He had been filing appeals, and on his appeals, there was a cell phone number. Or it was a home number, it was a number. So I called El Burro because according to the indictment, he was the linchpin between the cartel and my family. He was the guy bringing in the narco money and taking away the goods and whatever it was he was doing. So I call him. I'm like, is this Mr. Camacho, a.k.a. El Burro? And he's like, see, yes, it's me. I speak decent Spanish, and we were speaking Spanish. And I ask him, because I want to understand, why did you come to my family store? Why did you decide that the Shahani store was where you were going to do your business? Were you doing your business everywhere, or did you choose us in particular? And part of me wanted to know, is there just something I didn't know about my dad or my uncle? I was still open to that. I had no attachment to the outcome. He's like, I never met your family. I never went to that store. They made it up. I have no idea what they're talking about. Now, here's the thing. It took me all of 2 minutes of a phone call with a person listed on an indictment to get that pretty damning rejection of charges. Our very fancy lawyer couldn't have made that same call. He didn't bother.
I'm talking to NPR's Arthie Shahani about her memoir, Here We Are, and her family's immigration journey. We'll be back in just a minute. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, saluting Earth Day on April 22nd with an ongoing commitment to help offset carbon emissions with sustainable harvesting of Missouri forests. Details at choosewood.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to a conversation recorded Friday night. Aarti Shahani was in town to discuss her new book, Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares, which is about her family's immigration story. Aarti is NPR's Silicon Valley correspondent. I returned to our conversation by noting how she wrote about how her father, who was this old world guy, must have been taken aback by the fact that his most ambitious kid was his younger daughter. She wrote, "A daughter presents to a man an existential crisis. He spent his whole life learning there are differences between the sexes. Because that story has worked in his favor, it's in his self-interest to reinforce it. But it's also in his self-interest to see his offspring leap as far as possible to achieve the dreams he could not." So I asked her when he came around.
I'd mentioned that my dad and uncle took guilty pleas. They thought they were serving 8 months, but then it spiraled into a second surprise punishment, deportation. My uncle, we learned about deportation with my uncle first. We thought he was coming home from his sentence. And actually, he served 2.5 years instead of 8 months because New York State made a mistake. So the judge in the case, the reason the judge was so fond of me, the one I've mentioned who I interviewed for this book, is as a teenager, I began writing to the judge to sort out the errors that the state had made. I became the advocate for my family, and the judge got my letters and he responded to them. On the record in court, he called me his most frequent pen pal. Mm-hmm. That's the relationship we had formed while I was trying to sort out the mess. So the day my uncle was supposed to come home, he went missing. 1, 2, 3, then 4 days. We had no idea where he was. Homecoming party turns into a search party. We literally have no idea where he is. I'm at that point a student at the University of Chicago. High school is done. And I get a call. It's my father. We have no idea where my uncle is. It's my father. My father is crying. I'd never heard him cry before. And my father says, "Aarti Dahl, they took him. They took him." "Who took who?" "Immigration. They took Uncle Ratham. They took him." I'm like, "What are you talking about?" He's like, "For deportation." Deportation, like that word sent a shockwave through my body. Because I was like, "Well, we're American. What are you talking about?" I was like, "You gotta be wrong." But something that really struck me is I am the first person my father called when he finally found out where his disappeared brother was.
Because he knew you could take care of business.
Exactly. It wasn't anybody else. It wasn't another brother in his huge family. It wasn't his eldest son. It wasn't a trusted. It was his little girl. And I would say that it's not like Dad stopped to say, "Aarti Dahl, I was wrong about gender norms." No. We never had that reckoning. It's that through living life together, he started to see me in ways he could not have imagined a woman to be. And I'll say that something else happened. I saw him as a much more multidimensional person. He stopped being the old world introverted crank who got in my way. And I started to recognize, oh my God, this is a man who was pretty much fated to a life of utter irrelevance and starting over, over and over, because of the circumstances he was born into. My father spoke 6 languages, had a fantastic memory, and could multiply very large numbers in his head. He was a brilliant man. If he were born into this country with U.S. citizenship, with the stability that we have here today, he would have been a hedge fund manager. He would have been, you know, at the State Department. He would have had some kind of job where he got to sort of realize his self-worth. That he never got that.
Instead, he ends up at Rikers Island.
He ends up a prisoner and ultimately fated to live and, you know, ultimately his life ended with, you know, what was his legacy? On paper, he was a criminal alien.
So going there to the end of his life, as you're talking about his legacy there, part of his journey that I found, frankly, surprising is that in the end, when he was still in good health, you were able to help him to get back to India, and he got to see family there. It sounds like he had a great trip. And yet when he became very ill when he was on that trip, rather than sort of ride that out and see what happens in India, where he had plenty of people to sort of keep an eye on him, you ended up making the decision, at great expense to yourself and great discomfort, to fly him back to the United States. Why did you decide to do that?
So my father, he went to India toward the end of his life. He landed in ICU. And I was getting very different messages from relatives. Like, one relative is like, your father is about to die. Another relative, everything's fine. He just needs some dosa and chai. Everything will be okay. Another relative, no, you must come here. It is your duty to be with your father. Like, there, and you know, like, families have a way of offering a lot of opinions. Like, it's just, you know, I'm sure we all know this. It's like, when you need them least, they have the most. And ultimately, the doctor at the hospital was like, my dear, I think that, you know, if your siblings and you are going to come here, now is the time, because I'm not sure how much longer he has. It was wild to me, and it presented to me a kind of existential crisis. I fought until age 30 to keep my father in this country. And then I am realizing that he might actually pass away in India. And I thought to myself, it was a nagging thought I'd had the entire time I was fighting. Arthi, are you fighting the wrong battle? Are you misguided about America? Is America not actually your country? Is it not actually your father's country? Dad is going to pass away in the land he actually belonged in this whole time. Mm-hmm. It wasn't here.
But so you did choose to bring him back here, even though there was a part of you that thought maybe he should have stayed.
I don't even think I chose to bring him back here. I mean, it's funny because I reflected on in the book, for all the years I fought to keep my family in this country, when I was fighting that fight, I didn't stop to ask my father what he wanted. Mm-hmm. I didn't say, hey, Dad, do you want us to fight?
I was like, over my dead body are they taking him away? We belong here. You know, my name is Arthi. For the longest time, I called myself Artie. Like, I literally could not pronounce my own name. That's how American I was. Okay.
And so, in India, when I got there to my father's bedside in the hospital, and he was in ICU, I was like, Dad, shall we all just stay here for a bit? He's like, no, take me home.
And by home, he meant the U.S.?
Yeah.
And so you did.
I did.
Kind of an amazing flight. ended up putting out a credit card or having a family member help so that you could fly in first class.
The same business class, the same auntie who got us green cards in the U.S. spotted me the credit card to buy the business class tickets to literally lug my father's body across the ocean back to here. And it was funny, like the credit card, the tickets, it cost $7,000. I didn't have that kind of money. I didn't have that kind of money, you know. And it's funny because now, you know, I can thank my blessings. I do. I have a, you know, I'm now a homeowner. I have a
and in California, no less.
In California, no less.
That's a major accomplishment.
Like the book, you know, the subheading, it's here we are, a statement of fact, here we are. The subheading, American dreams, American nightmares. It's not just American nightmares. Okay. My father lived the nightmare. But I would be really disingenuous to not acknowledge I have lived the dream. And what I mean by I have lived the dream, not that it was easy. I mean, I detail in this book how the quote-unquote justice system derailed my life. I grew up in the shadow of a legal case that was supposed to go away but never did. And that's a very common experience in America. Okay, we're not the only ones. But I also got to leap in ways that would never have happened back home. And my mother, my very boisterous mom, who is an amazing character in real life, let alone in the book, she reminds me of that a lot.
So let's talk a little bit about that. I know that probably a lot of people are here tonight because they're interested in your career at NPR. And just to remind people, we're talking to Arthi Shahani about her new book, Here We Are. You ended up transitioning to fighting for your father's case to becoming basically a community organizer, mm-hmm. and then from there to journalism, which is really kind of an unusual path.
Yeah.
Not many journalists come out of community organizing. Tell us a little bit about that journey, how you ended up becoming this NPR reporter.
Yeah, I feel like I, in the process of fighting for my dad, the September 11th attacks happened. And what I saw occurring was the political campaign I was working on to reform the immigration laws. It was a bipartisan campaign. Republicans and Democrats both supported it. It fell apart. We had a new political chapter, a new historical chapter in this country where immigrants were going to be scapegoated and demonized. And I saw a bunch of other New Yorkers, people from my community, being picked up and rounded up. I accidentally started a nonprofit. And I was doing that work, that political work, as an activist, as an organizer, for about a decade. And then I just burned out really badly. And I mean, like, ugly burnout. I mean the kind of burnout where, like, I was laying on the sofa and I could finish a bag of Doritos and then have the Ben and Jerry's ice cream and then pass out without brushing my teeth. It was kind of like that kind of...
That's bad burnout.
It's like over and over and over again. It was like sad. And it was interesting because one day I chatted with a friend of mine, a good friend of mine, and she mentioned she was applying for graduate school. And, you know, this was a huge difference for my dad and I. We both dealt with depression. But my father, the challenges we had in this country weren't his first rodeo. He was already tired by the time he got here. It was my first rodeo. So when a girlfriend mentioned, oh, I'm applying to grad schools, I was like, wait, there's an out? Like, I just didn't know that there was a way for me to leave being an immigrant daughter, you know?
And to just start over.
Yeah, I just didn't know. And so kind of in the last minute, I had like maybe 10 days or 2 weeks, just a short period of time, I threw my hat in the ring to Harvard.
You know, just start at the bottom.
Well, well, I think it's more like I didn't have any real plan. And so I was like, let me just toss something out. I don't know. Maybe it'll stick.
You know, just for the record, this is not the normal path to a great journalism.
Well, I mean, there are like a lot of funny things to me about my path into journalism. But anyway, I got into Harvard, the School of Government there. And they gave me a full ride. They said, you're accepted and we're paying for it. I didn't go in to Harvard for a master's degree thinking, I want to be a journalist when I come out. I just went in thinking, I want to obliterate my entire identity and start over. And what can do it? Well, the H-bomb can do it. You know, that can help to redefine me.
And it did it.
It did it. Because you know what? Had I been exactly who I am, with my skills, my ability to find anyone who is relevant and get them to talk to me, journalists and community organizers have a lot in common. The way that you have to find relevant people, the way that you have to pull out information for them, the way you have to tell stories to move people. Journalists and community organizers have a lot in common. But the fact is, there's a fear in the news industry of activism, of sort of being biased in certain ways that are not fair to our audience. So if I had tried to pivot from activism right into mainstream media at a major news organization, there's no way I would have been let in. There's no way. But the H-bomb helped. Suddenly I could say, oh, I'm just a student at Harvard. Now, interestingly, my entry to NPR, though, I happened to do a summer internship in news. And I wrote a story that got on the front page of the Washington Post. And then an NPR journalist who remembered me as a source, I was helping him go into immigrant prisons and interview people who'd been horrifically abused. He's like, Aarti Shahani, is that the same woman who was a community activist?
Here she is on the front page of the Washington Post.
Reporting on transportation safety. And he's like, what the heck are you doing? I'm like, I guess I'm trying to be you. And he brought me into NPR through a fellowship. And I quickly became a technology reporter. I chose technology not because my dad ran an electronics store and I had a thing for gadgets. It wasn't a daddy issue there. Technology was a huge and safe distance from anything I'd ever been an activist on. So people who are gatekeepers, editors, people who would decide, hey, are you fit to do this thing? They wouldn't be suspicious of me on the tech beat. Whereas, for example, you know, I make this point in the book. If you worked at Goldman Sachs or your daddy worked at Goldman Sachs in the news industry, that qualifies you to be a business reporter. If you were locked up or your daddy was locked up in the news industry, that does not qualify you to be a criminal justice reporter.
If anything, people might try to say, oh, that's a conflict of interest. She can't report on this.
So it's really only a conflict of interest when you're dealing with working people, not when you're dealing with elites. That's a problem we deal with in our newsrooms.
Yeah.
So anyway, I chose Silicon Valley. And then Silicon Valley chose me back, and I became, you know, basically within 3 years, I fast-tracked myself into a really fantastic job. And it's fascinating, right? Because I spent my 20s with immigrant prisoners and families. And I spent my 30s with incredibly wealthy business leaders and software engineers and sort of tech bros. What that tells me is I really like intense and different people. My ability to be at ease with those very different kinds of people, I believe, is thanks to Flushing, Queens, and my upbringing in apartment 401 with all of those different neighbors. Really, the training I got as a working class kid in that diverse community has prepared me for the modern workforce.
That was my conversation with Aarti Shahani, recorded Friday at the community room of UMSL at Grand Center. Aarti's book, Here We Are, is available at local bookstores. That includes The Novel Neighbor, which was our co-host for Friday's event. We want to thank them for making it possible. Podcast episodes of St. Louis on the Air are available at stlpublicradio.org, or you can subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts, the Google Podcast app, or wherever you get your podcasts. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Sarah Fenske.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, saluting Earth Day on April 22nd with an ongoing commitment to help offset carbon emissions with sustainable harvesting of Missouri forests. Details at choosewood.com.